Hello.
Ladies and gentlemen, this is Dan Trotter, Pretty Good Bible Studies. I am going to cover in this audio 1 Kings chapter 14, verses 1 through 31, which I'll entitle Ahijah the Shilonite's Prophecy Against Jeroboam. In our last chapter, to give us our context, we had Jeroboam, who had gone to the northern 10 tribes of Israel, set up his golden calf worship at Dan in the north and Bethel in the south. And so in chapter 14, a prophet from Judah goes up to Jeroboam as he's offering sacrifices on his golden calf altar in Bethel. And this prophet from Judah says, "You're toast. This altar, bones are going to be sacrificed on the altar. Later on, a king Josiah is going to do it." And then Jeroboam's arm withered, the altar split in half, and it was a very, I'm sure, frightening situation for King Jeroboam. And then we saw how this prophet from Judah went back to Judah. He was supposed to go back to Judah and not mess around, but he stopped at a prophet who lied to him, said, "God told you to stay here," and as a result, the prophet from Judah got eaten up by a lion. That was the last chapter. So we start now in 1 Kings chapter 14, verses 1 through 4. At that time, Abijah, son of Jeroboam, became ill. Jeroboam, by the way, ruled from 931 to 910 BC, just to get us chronologically oriented. At that time, Abijah, son of Jeroboam, and Jeroboam said to his wife, "Go disguise yourself so you won't be recognized as the wife of Jeroboam. Then go to Shiloh. Abijah the prophet is there, the one who told me I would be king over this people. Take 10 loaves of bread with you, some cakes and a jar of honey, and go to him. He will tell you what will happen to the boy." So Jeroboam's wife did what he said and went to Ahijah's house in Shiloh. Now Ahijah could not see. His sight was gone because of his age. Before I get started, I want to geographically orient you, if I can, with some of these place names. We start with Jerusalem, which I assume you know where that is. Go about 10 miles north, you get to Bethel. Go about 10 miles a little bit north and northeast, you get to Shiloh, which is where Ahijah the Shilonite, the Shilonite, Ahijah the prophet, that same prophet who told Jeroboam he was going to have 10 pieces of Israel, signified by the 10 torn pieces of Ahijah's cloak. So that's Shiloh, 10 miles north of Bethel. And Bethel, of course, is where the golden calf altar was put. Now, if you go 10 miles, about 10 miles north of Shiloh, you get to Shechem, that very famous city, present-day Nablus, where originally Jeroboam had been proclaimed king of Israel in chapter 12. And that's where the big split occurred. And Rehoboam left from there and went back to Jerusalem. Now, if you go about 5 miles to the northeast of Shechem, you get to Tirzah. And Jeroboam had moved his capital from Shechem to Tirzah by this time. So going from north to south, you got Tirzah, Shechem, Shiloh, Bethel, Jerusalem. Tirzah, Shechem, Shiloh, Bethel, and Jerusalem. Tirzah is in the north there. It's not up to the Sea of Galilee yet, but it's getting up there. So that's the place names. Now we need to get oriented as far as the people. And the problem with this is all the Hebrew names sound just like each other. Reminds me of being in China. I could not distinguish anybody because all the names sounded exactly alike to my Western ear. So we're going to have to do some distinguishing here. So let's start with Ahijah. He's the prophet that had the cloak that was torn into 12 pieces, 10 of which were given to Jeroboam in a previous chapter. That's Ahijah, with an H, Ahijah the Shilonite. And now here in 1 Kings 14:1, we've got Abijah, not Ahijah, but Abijah, who's Jeroboam's sixth son. Now later on, we're going to take a peek at the southern kingdom of Judah, where King Rehoboam is. And Rehoboam had a son, and he was named Abijam, J-A-M. I'm going to pronounce it weird, just to emphasize the jam, Abijam. And to make it more complicated, Chronicles, Abijam is how Kings call Rehoboam's son, but Chronicles calls Abijam Abijah, which is the same name that Jeroboam the northern king has. So the northern and southern king have kids of the same name, except that Kings calls Rehoboam's kid Abijam, and that's what we're going to call him to distinguish. So now that we are hopefully not thoroughly confused, which is quite possible, we'll start with verse 1. At that time, Abijah, not Ahijah the Shilonite, but Abijah with a B. At that time, Abijah, son of Jeroboam, became ill. Now, what time was this? This is probably at the end of Jeroboam's reign. At that time is a phrase that's used often loosely and indefinitely in sacred histories. Jameson Fawcett and Brown saying, of course, that's true. But we know that his son Abijah, Jeroboam, son of Abijah, was considered by the people to be heir to the throne, according to James Fawcett and Brown. And also we know in verse 4 that Ahijah the Shilonite, the prophet, was old and blind when Jeroboam's wife went to see him, so that's probably near the end of his reign. Now again, the reign is between 931 and 910 B.C., and incidentally, as far as chronology, I'm going to use Thiele's dates, T-H-I-E-L-E, the famous evangelical scholar whose dates seem to have won universal approval. The famous scholar Albright has an alternate set of dates, but I think he's been overcome now by Thiele, and I sure hope I'm pronouncing his name right because I don't know, but that's T-H-I-E-L-E, and we're going to use Thiele's dates. Okay, so at some time near the end of Jeroboam's reign, his son got sick. Jeroboam says to his wife, go see Ahijah. Now, who this wife is unknown. We don't know what the name of Jeroboam's queen was. He tells her to disguise herself. Now, why would he do that? Here's some possible reasons. Jeroboam perhaps did not want the people to know he was inquiring of the true prophets of Yahweh, because Ahijah was not a golden calf prophet. He was a Yahweh prophet. If people had found out what Jeroboam was doing, that could have undermined the stability of his whole political system. Another reason why he wanted his wife to go instead of him was because Jeroboam could have been scared that Ahijah would give him a harsh answer, which he did, because Ahijah would be angry because of Jeroboam's apostasy. When Ahijah had prophesied earlier, torn his cloak, gave Jeroboam 10 pieces of the new cloak, Ahijah did not expect Jeroboam to go set up golden calves. As an apostate from Yahweh, he expected him to rule Israel justly, without idolatry, and he didn't do it, and so Jeroboam probably was feeling a little guilty and probably a little afraid what Ahijah was going to tell him. But at any rate, whatever his reasons were, it was foolish for Jeroboam to think that a prophet could predict the future for him but could not see through a disguise, and we're going to see that Ahijah did see through the disguise because God gave him a word. This is Jeroboam's wife coming to see you. Now remember, Ahijah's blind now, but nonetheless, he knew who was coming. So the disguise was a waste of time, was foolishness. I mentioned already about Shiloh. I didn't mention that it was in the tribe of Ephraim. Again, it goes Jerusalem, Bethel, and Shiloh, and then further north of that is Shechem. So Jeroboam started out in Shechem, moved north to Tirzah. He was north of Shiloh, but Ahijah the Shilonite was south of him in Shiloh. Now, Jeroboam mentions in verse 2 that this Ahijah the Shilonite was the one who told me I would be king over this people, and that came to pass. So Jeroboam trusted him as a prophet who could tell the future. I've mentioned that several times. Let me read it here. 1 Kings 11, verses 29 through 31. During that time, the prophet Ahijah the Shilonite met Jeroboam on the road as Jeroboam came out of Jerusalem. Now, Ahijah had wrapped himself with a new cloak, and the two of them were alone in the open field. Then Ahijah took hold of the new cloak he had on, tore it into 12 pieces, and said to Jeroboam, take 10 pieces for yourself, for this is what the Lord God of Israel says. I am about to tear the kingdom out of Solomon's hand. I will give you 10 tribes. Dot, dot, dot. And that came to pass. So in verse 3, Jeroboam tells his wife, take 10 loaves of bread with you, some cakes, a jar of honey. That's very typical. You go to a prophet and ask for prophecy. You give him a gift. I even hate to mention this because it sounds like he's paying him off, buying a prophecy, if you will. But that seems to be the custom those prophets had to eat. Now, what did Jeroboam want to find out from Ahijah? He will tell you what will happen to the boy, he says to the wife. He just wants to know the future of the boy, Abijah, his son. He didn't ask the prophet about what might be done to help the child's recovery, some kind of medical advice. He didn't request Ahijah the Shilonite's prayers for recovery of the child, Abijah. He just wanted to know what was going to happen. Well, some people say that he just had political reasons for inquiring, wanted to know if his heir to the throne is going to die. That, of course, is a huge concern of every ancient king, as well as medieval European king. But maybe Jeroboam had fatherly feelings for Abijah also. We'll give him the benefit of the doubt and assume he did. We go down to 1 Kings 14, verses 5 through 9. But the Lord had told Ahijah, that's Ahijah the Shilonite, the prophet, Jeroboam's wife is coming to ask you about her son, for he is ill, and you are to give her such and such an answer. When she arrives, she will pretend to be someone else. So when Ahijah heard the sound of her footsteps at the door, he said, "Come in, wife of Jeroboam. Why this pretense? I have been sent to you with bad news. Go tell Jeroboam that this is what the Lord, the God of Israel, says. I raised you up from among the people and made you a leader over my people Israel. I tore the kingdom away from the house of David and gave it to you. But you have not been like my servant David, who kept my commands and followed me with all his heart, doing only what was right in my eyes. You have done more evil than all who lived before you. You have made for yourself other gods, idols made of metal. You have provoked me to anger and thrust me behind your back." Well, so far the prophecy's not good. Now, when the wife realized that Ahijah immediately knew who she was, despite the fact that Ahijah was blind, that must have kind of taken her off her foundation a little bit. She probably realized that this was indication that bad news was about to come. Notice that Ahijah the Shilonite prefaces his statement with, "The Lord, this is what the Lord Yahweh, the God of Israel, says." Ooh, God still is said to be the God of Israel, even though Israel had revolted from him. Assuming that Israel here is referring to the northern 10 tribes, well, even if it's referring to the whole north and south, still, God is God of both north and south. I don't care about your golden calves. Ooh, not good from Jeroboam's wife's point of view. Ahijah the Shilonite contrasts Jeroboam's kingdom, or contrast Jeroboam with David, who, says Ahijah the Shilonite, "David kept my commands and followed me with all his heart." Well, you hear that a lot. You read that a lot in the Old Testament. Of course, the first thing I think of, well, did he keep his God's commands? He had committed adultery with Bathsheba and then murdered Uriah? Well, these writers are worried about idolatry. That's the number one thing. Are you following Yahweh or not? All you have to do is read through Samuel and Kings. You realize that was the number one concern God had. And David was very good on that point. And that's why he is said to have kept God's commands and followed God with all of his heart. Now, Ahijah keeps on going and said, "You, Jeroboam," he's talking to Jeroboam's wife, but he's saying, "Go back and tell your husband that you have done more evil than all who lived before you." And again, the evil is referring to God's idols made of metal. "You've really done a bad thing, Jeroboam. You've made two golden calves for Israel to worship." Well, all those who came before, that was David. He never committed adultery despite the adultery and murder. No adultery. Saul, despite the fact that he was a jerk and didn't listen to what Samuel said, didn't listen to what God said, he never gave in to idolatry. And Solomon, of course, was guilty of adultery in some instances, but he didn't attempt to draw the people into it. He just tried to satisfy his wives. He set a bad example. Now, it's possible that Rehoboam and maybe even Abijam might have been dead at this time, so they might be included in all those who came before Jeroboam. Well, one of my commentators says, although they were blameworthy in some things, that they were not as bad as Jeroboam. That might be a matter of opinion. But at any rate, in general, no, Jeroboam, he was the number one idolater at this time in the history of Israel. We go now to 1 Kings 14, 10 through 11. Ahijah the Shilonite continues telling Jeroboam's wife what the wife needs to go back and tell Jeroboam. Verse 10, "Because of this, I am going to bring," because of all that idolatry, "I am going to bring disaster on the house of Jeroboam. I will cut off from Jeroboam every last male in Israel, slave or free. I will burn up the house of Jeroboam as one burns dung until it is all gone. Dogs will eat those belonging to Jeroboam who die in the city, and the birds of the air will feed on those who die in the country. The Lord has spoken." Oh, encouraging word from the prophet. "I will cut off from Jeroboam every last male in Israel." The King James has, "I will cut off from Jeroboam all. I will cut off from Jeroboam him that pisseth against the wall." I have to make a little rabbit trail here. I had a friend who was being seduced by the King James only nonsense. He was telling me that King James version he thought would be the only version that we ought to use. And I said, "Friend, I will not use a Bible, and I will not let my children use a Bible that has the word piss in it. I'm just not going to do it." Saves a lot of learned argument against those characters, King James only people. All right, back from the rabbit trail. We're going to see how Jeroboam had every last male cut off in the next couple of verses. We'll hold that till we get there. In summary, Ahijah says, "Dogs will eat those belonging to Jeroboam who die in the city, and the birds of the air will feed on those who die in the country." They're all going to get cut off. Now, this expression, "dogs eating those who die in the city and birds feeding on those who die in the country. That's a common expression in the Bible. Let me give you an example in 1 Kings 16:4. Anyone of Baasha who dies in the city, the dog shall eat, and anyone of his who dies in the field, the birds of the heavens will eat. It just means they're going to have an inglorious end. 1 Kings 21:24, the one belonging to Ahab who dies in the city, the dog shall eat, and the one who dies in the field, the birds of heaven shall eat. Pulpit commentary says this, quote, "Dogs, it is well known, are the scavengers of eastern cities. They exist there in great numbers and in a semi-savage state, and the carcasses of animals and carrion of all sorts are left for them to consume, which they do most effectually, roaming the streets all night in search of garbage and in search of dead corpses." So basically what this verse is saying is nobody of Jeroboam's house is going to get a proper burial. Now, this was a terrible threat to a Jew, as the pulpit commentary says. Pulpit commentary says that fate is, the quote, "the climax of disgrace and misfortune." And the pulpit commentary quotes several verses, lots of verses. I'm going to read you two of them that show what a terrible threat to Jews this was, why they hated the idea of having their bodies thrown out in the streets or in the countryside. Psalm 79:2, "They gave the corpses of your servants to the birds of the sky for food, the flesh of your godly ones to the beast of the earth." And of course, that's considered to be a bad thing. Jeremiah 7:33, "The corpses of these people," referring to the people of Judah, "will become food for the birds of the sky and for the wild animals of the land, with no one to scare them away." And then there's Jeremiah 16:4, Jeremiah 34:20, Ezekiel 29:5, etc., etc., etc. Lots of times this curse is mentioned. When was this fulfilled in Jeroboam's case? Well, in our next chapter, 1 Kings 15:29, we read this. "When Baasha became king, he struck down the entire house of Jeroboam. He did not leave Jeroboam any survivors, but destroyed his family according to the word of the Lord he had spoken through his servant Ahijah the Shilonite." And all my commentaries say that 1 Kings 15:29 is referring back to this prophecy that Ahijah has given to Jeroboam's wife. Let me read it for you again. Verse 10, "I will cut off from Jeroboam every last male in Israel. I will burn up the house of Jeroboam as one burns dung until it is all gone." So Ahijah, he was accurate about giving the kingdom to Jeroboam, and he was accurate about God taking away the kingdom from Jeroboam. We go now to 1 Kings 14, verses 12 through 16. Ahijah the Shilonite continues speaking to Jeroboam's wife. He says this, "As for you, wife, go back home when you set foot in your city," and that, of course, is Tirzah, where she and Jeroboam are living at this point, north of Shechem, about 10 miles or so, or 5 miles. "When you set foot in your city, the boy," that's Abijah, your son, Abijah, "will die. All Israel will mourn for him and bury him. He is the only one belonging to Jeroboam who will be buried, because he is the only one in the house of Jeroboam in whom the Lord, the God of Israel, has found anything good. The Lord will raise up for himself a king over Israel who will cut off the family of Jeroboam. This is the day." What? Yes, even now. "And the Lord will strike Israel so that it will be like a reed swaying in the water. He will uproot Israel from this good land that he gave to their forefathers and scatter them beyond the river, because they provoked the Lord to anger by making Asherah poles. And he will give Israel up because of the sins Jeroboam has committed and has caused Israel to commit." So Ahijah the Shilonite tells Jeroboam's wife, "Your son Abijah is the only one of your descendants, yours and Jeroboam's descendants, who will be buried. The rest are going to be out on the street getting eaten up by dogs and out in the countryside getting eaten up by birds. But your son Abijah, the one who's sick, the one whom you came to ask me about, he's going to be buried. He's the only one that did anything good." Now, what good is not recorded here in the scriptures, but Jewish writers, according to Gill and Jameson, Fawcett, and Brown, claim that this boy, Abijah, or this man now, well, he calls him a boy in the NIV, so we'll assume he's a young man at least. He was decidedly opposed to the erection of the golden calves, according to the Jewish rabbis, and he also used his influence with his father to allow his subjects to go down south to Jerusalem and worship at the true temple in Jerusalem. But he died, and he's gone now. Verse 14, Ahijah the Shilonite, the prophet, tells Jeroboam's wife that the Lord will raise up for himself a king over Israel. That will be referring to Baasha. I've already mentioned him. I'll read the where this is fulfilled again. 1 Kings 15:29, and it came about as soon as he was king, he struck down all the household of Jeroboam. That he is Baasha, referring to Baasha. Baasha was a rebel. He was not of the house of Jeroboam. He was a different family. He was a rebel. Struck down all the household of Jeroboam. He did not leave to Jeroboam any persons alive until he had destroyed them, according to the word of the Lord, which he spoke, or which he had spoken, by his servant Ahijah the Shilonite. And, of course, that's the prophecy we're looking at right now in chapter 14, 1 Kings. Now, we know it's Baasha because if we back up a couple of verses in 1 Kings 15, verses 27 and 28, we read this. Then Baasha, son of Ahijah of the house of Issachar, that's a different Ahijah, one more name to be confused. Let's forget that. Just Baasha of the house of Issachar conspired against Nadab. Nadab was Jeroboam's son and successor who ruled in the northern 10 tribes of Israel. Baasha conspired against Nadab, and Baasha struck him down at Gibbethon of the Philistines, while Nadab and all Israel were besieging Gibbethon. In the third year of Judah's kings, Asa, Baasha killed Nadab and reigned in his place. Nadab is Jeroboam's son and successor. So, the prophecy of Ahijah the Shilonite came true to the letter, and in fact, it's going to come true very shortly in the next chapter, 1 Kings 15. Nadab only ruled 2 years, by the way, after Jeroboam died. Verse 15, Ahijah the Shilonite says Israel, when Baasha comes and wipes out the house of Jeroboam by killing Jeroboam's son Nadab, when that happens, Israel will be like a reed swaying in the water. Now, if you look at a reed growing up out of the water currents can make its way, the wind can make its way. The reed is very unstable, and that's the point of the metaphor. Northern Israel is going to be extremely unstable. And in fact, Ahijah the Shilonite, the prophet, continues, God will uproot Israel from this good land, and now we're talking about northern Israel, the northern 10 tribes, and scatter them beyond the river. And this is referring, of course, to the Euphrates River. And when did that happen? That happened in 722 BC, when Sargon II took Samaria and then took the Israelites, the northern Israelites, and scattered them all throughout the Assyrian Empire. Assyria, of course, being in Mesopotamia, present-day Iraq. Sargon II did that in 722 BC. He was the king of Assyria in 722, but the siege of Samaria had started 3 years earlier. That had been started by Shalmaneser V for 3 years, a three-year siege. So what Ahijah the Shilonite said came to pass, and that was really an uprooting of Israel, because those 10 tribes had never been found again, despite some people claiming they're in Israel and all other sorts of nonsense. They're gone. They never came. Well, they might have come back with the southern tribes too in the return from Babylon, 538, when Persia let the southern Israelites come back to Judah and Benjamin, come back to Jerusalem. So they might have come back with those, but other than that, we don't know what happened to them. So they really did get uprooted. Now, one little comment about this river. Whenever it says the river, you just assume it's the Euphrates. Some people have suggested this might be, in more particular, the Gozan River. Well, I got curious about that, so I looked it up. Before I look at the map, let me read to you 2 Kings 18:11. The king of Assyria deported the Israelites to Assyria and put them in Hala by the Kabor, Gozan's River. Well, if you look at a map, the Euphrates River now is running just straight southeast and northwest here by the time it gets up into Syria, heading toward present-day Turkey. And if you look at Haran, where the river then turns and goes north and is right up at the north, even with the northern end of the Mediterranean Sea. Haran, of course, is where Abraham came from, famous city. It's still there. Everybody knows where it is. It's 10 miles north of the Syrian border in southern Turkey. And there's a river that goes straight down from Haran, straight north to south into the Euphrates River. That river is the Balik. Well, if you go, I don't know, maybe 25 miles or so due east of Haran, you get to a branch of a river. That's the Kabor River, which runs into the Euphrates further southeast of the Balik. The Balik runs straight up to Halan. You go southeast on the Euphrates. You get to the Kabor River, go north, and then the river branches to the left, to the west a little bit, and there's a town called Gozan there. And some people say that's the Gozan River, the river that's part of the Kabor River. Well, if that's the case, if that's where the exiles went to, we could say that's the river they went to. So, but it doesn't matter. The point is, it's so close to the Euphrates anyway. It's the same idea. The Israelites, the northern Israelites, are kaput because of Jeroboam's golden calf idolatry. We go down to verses 17 through 20 of 1 Kings 14. Then Jeroboam's wife got up and left and went to Tirzah. As soon as she stepped over the threshold of the house, the boy, that's Abijah, her son, died. They buried him, and all Israel mourned for him, as the Lord had said through his servant, the prophet Ahijah. That's Ahijah the Shilonite, whose prophecy we just read. He said the boy's going to die. The other events of Jeroboam's reign, his wars, and how he ruled, are written in the Book of the Annals of the Kings of Israel. He reigned for 22 years and then rested with his fathers, and Nadab, his son, succeeded him as king. I've already told you about Tirzah. That's the capital city now of the northern kingdom, Jeroboam's capital city as of now. Here's an interesting comment about Tirzah. This is from Jameson Fawcett and Brown, who's quoting another commentator named Stanley. Tirzah is, quote, a place of preeminent beauty, 3 hours traveling east of Samaria, chosen when Israel became a separate kingdom by the first monarch, that's Jeroboam, and used during 3 short reigns as a residence of the royal house. The fertile plains and wooded hills in that part of the territory of Ephraim gave an opening to the formation of parks and pleasure grounds, similar to those which were the paradises of Assyrian and Persian monarchs. So maybe that's why Jeroboam moved the capital up to Tirzah, because it was such a beautiful place. Now, the wars of Jeroboam are mentioned in verse 19, recorded in the annals of the Book of Kings. What wars? Well, Jeroboam had wars with Rehoboam, the southern king of Judah, 1 Kings 14:30, which we'll get to in just a minute. There was war between Rehoboam and Jeroboam throughout their reigns. Now remember, Shemaiah the prophet had told Rehoboam, don't go up there and fight Jeroboam, right when they were about to have their civil war, when the kingdom divided, as I reported in 1 Kings chapter 12. Well, that was at the beginning, but as time went on, they ended up fighting. Now we can hop over to 2 Chronicles and look at some of this fighting between Jeroboam, and maybe not fighting between Jeroboam and Rehoboam, but fighting between Jeroboam and Abijam, who is also known as Abijah, Abijam with an M on the end, the son of Rehoboam in the south. So let's look at those battles. 2 Chronicles 13:15. The men of Judah raised the battle cry. When the men of Judah raised the battle cry, God routed Jeroboam and all Israel before Abijah, and again that's Abijam in Judah. So Rehoboam's son Abijam wiped out Jeroboam, 2 Chronicles 13:17. Then Abijah, that's Abijam, and his people struck them with a mighty blow, and 500,000 choice men of Israel were killed. So Jeroboam got wiped out again. Actually, it's the same battle, actually. 2 Chronicles 13:19. Abijah, that's Abijam, 2 Chronicles way of saying Abijam, the southern son of Rehoboam. Abijam pursued Jeroboam and captured some cities from him, Bethel and its villages, Jeshana and its villages, and Ephron and its villages. So Jeroboam is seen here to be getting clobbered. We go to 2 Chronicles 13:20. Jeroboam no longer retained his power during Abijah, that's Abijam's reign. Ultimately, the Lord struck him and he died. It wasn't during Abijam's reign that he died, but he died ultimately later after Abijam's reign. So we see here utter defeat for Jeroboam because of his golden calf idolatry. All of this is written in the annals of the Book of Kings. KJV has the Chronicles of the Book of Kings, but that's not the canonical Book of Chronicles that I've just referred to. For in that, as Gill says, there is very little account of the reign of Jeroboam. But the annals referred to here in verse 19 are the annals and diaries of the kings of Israel, written by persons appointed for that purpose, and out of which it is generally thought that inspired writers, by divine directions, took what was thought proper to be transmitted to future times. Yes, now we go to verse 20. Jeroboam reigned for 22 years. Using Thiele's dates, we have 931 to 910, which is 22 years. Remember, if you subtract the dates out, you got to allow a year or two for reign dates and pieces of years. I've gone through all that and I've gotten tired. Just remember, it's within 1 or 2 years, that's close enough. So 931 minus 910 is 21, which is 22 years. He outlived Rehoboam by 5 years. Rehoboam in the south was 931 to 914 or 931 to 914 or maybe 930 to 913. Thiele's dates are a little fuzzy there, but you could see it gives you a general feel of when all this is happening at the end of the 10th century B.C. Jeroboam actually lived to the second year of the reign of Rehoboam's grandson, Asa. So Rehoboam went to Abijam, and then Abijam had Asa, and that's when Jeroboam finally died. Nadab, in verse 20, is mentioned, Jeroboam's son, who took over in the north, hit Tirzah. He ruled for 2 years. That was between 910 and 909 B.C., according to Thiele's dates. So we go now to 1 Kings 14, verses 21 through 24. Rehoboam, son of Solomon, was king in Judah. That's in the south. He was 41 years old when he became king, and he reigned 17 years in Jerusalem, the city the Lord had chosen out of all the tribes of Israel in which to put his name. His mother's name was Naamah. That's N-A-A-M-A-H. She was an Ammonite. Judah did evil in the eyes of the Lord. By the sins they committed, they stirred up his jealous anger more than their fathers had done. They also set up for themselves high places, sacred stones, and Asherah poles on every high hill and under every spreading tree. There were even male shrine prostitutes, occult prostitutes, in the land. The people engaged in all the detestable practices of the nations the Lord had driven out before the Israelites. Well, the author of Kings has just finished talking about what a terrible idolater Jeroboam was. Well, it wasn't any better in the south. So Rehoboam reigned 17 years, and I said that was between 931 and 914, roughly. He reigned in Jerusalem. Why is this mentioned? To emphasize the rebellion of the northerners' evil of setting up Dan and Bethel as places to worship when the legal place to worship was Jerusalem. The city the Lord had chosen out of all of the tribes of Israel in which to put his name, that little detail was put in there to emphasize, hey guys, it's Jerusalem where the worship's supposed to be, not Dan and Bethel. Now, Naamah is the mother of Rehoboam. And remember, Rehoboam's father was Solomon, so that means Solomon had married Naamah. She was one of the thousand wives that Solomon had. She was an Ammonite, and she might have been the one that turned Solomon's heart to idolatry in regards to the Ammonite god Molech, the one that there was child sacrifice offered to. We read in 1 Kings 11:5, for Solomon went after Milcom, the abomination of the Ammonites. Milcom is another word for Molech, god to whom children were sacrificed. 1 Kings 11:7, then did Solomon build an high place for Molech, the abomination of the children of Ammon. Well, thank you, Naamah. We can give you credit for dragging your husband down into your idolatry. The southern Israelites stirred up the jealous anger of God more than the southern Israelites' fathers had done. Well, who were the fathers? That would be Moses, Joshua, the judges, and all the kings before the separation of the kingdom, the division of the kingdom, Saul, David, and Solomon. They didn't outdo the northern kings in evil, as I've just said. Saul, as nasty as he was and as rebellious as he was, he didn't get into idolatry. David, even though he committed adultery and murder, he didn't do idolatry. And Solomon didn't. I don't know about Solomon. He did a lot of idolatry. One of my commentators said he didn't push it on the people as much. I don't know about that. But in general, the fathers had not sunk into idolatry as much as the southern kingdom had now sunk. So now we're starting to see the degradation of the nation of Israel, both north and south, as they are split into two kingdoms, both of which are idolatrous. Now, the people in southern Israel also set up for themselves high places. This is typical. They would put shrines, idolatrous shrines, on hills at the top, I think, because the idea is we're closer to our God who lives in heaven somewhere. We're closer to him being up there in the high place. And they would do it under every spreading tree. It says they would find a grove there. And they would set up stones and poles. Sacred stones would be a substitute for the idol so they could worship the idol. And Asherah poles are those wooden poles that stood for Astarte, the Easter egg goddess with the many breasts, celebrated by colored eggs, who stood for fertility. She was a Canaanite goddess, focused mainly around present-day Lebanon, but whose idolatry went into Egypt, all through Mesopotamia, everywhere in the ancient Near East. And so it was in Israel too. And even worse than all that, it says they were even. That means even worse. They were male cult prostitutes in the land. KJV has that as sodomites because the shrine prostitutes were addicted to unnatural lust between men and men. which of course the men of Sodom were guilty of, and so that's where the name Sodomites comes from. That's where we get the name sodomy. And of course, I'm probably going to get canceled by YouTube for even mentioning the fact that homosexuality is a sin. It is a fundamental sin in the sense that it violates the way God created us. Male and female, he created them, as the book of Genesis says. In the image of God, he created them. Male and female, he created them. You start messing with God's created genders, and you are shaking your fist at the hands of God. And I don't care how many social justice warriors, I don't care how many cancel culture advocates, I don't care how many LGBTQ, LSMFT plus advocates say that I'm a homophobe. I don't care. Call God a homophobe if you will, and start looking for a place to dodge the lightning. We go down to 1 Kings 14, 25 through 28. In the fifth year, this is about 926 BC, in the fifth year of King Rehoboam, we're in the south now, King Rehoboam, Shishak, king of Egypt, attacked Jerusalem. He carried off the treasures of the temple of the Lord and the treasures of the royal palace. He took everything, including all the gold shields Solomon had made. So King Rehoboam made bronze shields to replace them and assigned these to the commanders of the guard on duty at the entrance to the royal palace. Whenever the king went to the Lord's temple, the guards bore the shields, and afterward they returned them to the guard room. Now this Shishak is the same Shishak that had sheltered Jeroboam the first. Remember in chapter 11, verse 40 of 1 Kings, Solomon sought therefore to kill Jeroboam. That's because Solomon figured out that Jeroboam had been prophesied by Ahijah the Shilonite that Jeroboam was going to take a part of the kingdom away from Solomon's son Rehoboam. And so Solomon sought to kill Jeroboam, and Jeroboam arose and fled into Egypt unto Shishak, king of Egypt, and was in Egypt until the death of Solomon. Well, Jeroboam was sheltered by Shishak, but now Jeroboam is not hooked up with the southern kingdom anymore, and so Shishak has no affinity for southern Israel anymore, Judah. And if it's the same Shishak that had provided a daughter to Solomon for Solomon to marry, well, Solomon's gone now, although some people say it's not the same Pharaoh. But at any rate, we know that Shishak's not related to Rehoboam, so he doesn't care. He goes in. He knows there's gold in the hills of Judah. Gold in the palace of Solomon and the palace of the and in the temple. Jameson Fawcett and Brown says of this Shishak, quote, he was the Shishonk, S-H-E-S-H-O-N-K, he was the Shishonk of the Egyptian monuments, who is depicted on a bas-relief at Karnak. Karnak is the famous big temple with the big fat pillars, one of the biggest temple in the world. I think that's true either in the ancient world or the modern world. It's the biggest thing you ever saw. It's worth a look at that place on Wikipedia, on the internet, or Wikipedia, anywhere on the internet. Just get pictures of Karnak. It's huge. It's so huge, it's ugly. But anyway, Shishak is on the walls there at Karnak as dragging captives who, from their peculiar physiognomy, are universally admitted to be Jews. I guess that's the curly black hair and the large noses. They figure these are Jews that Shishak is carrying into captivity. Well, here it is right here in 1 Kings 14. Shishak attacked Israel. And this, of course, is mentioned to show that Judah is being chastised for all the aforementioned idolatry. Shishak, in verse 26, took everything he could find. Now, that's everything he could find. He didn't take everything that was there because there was something that was left, because we can read in the next chapter, 1 Kings 15, 18, so Asa withdrew, that's Rehoboam's grandson, Asa withdrew all the silver and gold that remained in the treasuries of the Lord's temple and the treasuries of the royal palace and put it into the hands of his servants. Then King Asa sent all that treasure to Ben-Hadad, king of Aram, who lived in Damascus. So there was still something left by the time of Rehoboam's grandson, Asa. But it was everything he could find, including all the gold shields Solomon made. If you recall the house of the forest of Lebanon, many people speculate that was the armory. There were gold shields put in that armory, and the attendants of Solomon would carry those gold shields as they accompanied Solomon to worship in the temple. And remember, the temple is different from the palace. The house of the forest of Lebanon was in the palace complex, not the temple. You notice in verse 26, Shishak not only took the treasures of the temple, that would include the golden altar of incense. I wonder if he took all the gold that lined the paneled walls. I wonder if he took the ark. I don't know what he took, but he took. How about the golden lampstands? How about the basins? He took all that, plus the gold shields. The gold shields came from the palace, of course, not the temple. So King Rehoboam made bronze shields to replace the gold shields. Now, that shows that Solomon's kingdom was a golden age and Rehoboam's kingdom was a bronze age. You see the decline of the kingdom from gold to bronze. Now, these guards took these bronze shields and accompanied the king whenever Rehoboam went into the temple, the Lord's temple. Why would Rehoboam, the stupid idolater, why would he be going into the Lord's temple? Well, here are some options. He could be going to worship God. John Gill says, quote, though he had fallen into idolatry, he had not wholly forsaken the worship of God in the temple. In other words, Rehoboam could have been a syncretist, a compromiser. I'll worship God and I'll worship idols too, just to hedge my bets. Just like all other, or most other pagans in the world, they're not very exclusive in who they give their worshipful favors to. Or maybe Rehoboam was chastened, Gill speculates. Perhaps by the late humbling providence, he might be stirred up to attend there more frequently. In other words, the invasion by Shishak might have made Rehoboam repent and go to the temple. Well, that's speculation. I don't know. I tend to be a cynic about these things. People are so stupid and so hard-hearted against the Lord. I doubt this, that little invasion made Rehoboam a spiritual man. Could have. We don't know. We go to 1 Kings 14, verses 29 through 31. As for the other events of Rehoboam's reign and all he did, are they not written in the book of the annals of the kings of Judah? There was continual warfare between Rehoboam and Jeroboam, and Rehoboam rested with his fathers and was buried with them in the city of David. His mother's name was Naamah. She was an Ammonite. We've already noted that. And Abijah, well, the NIV has Abijah, but all the other translations have it as Abijam, and that's what we want to go by. Abijam, his son, succeeded him as king. And that's where we're going to end that chapter, right there with Abijam on the throne, Rehoboam dead. Now, Rehoboam's events are recorded in the annals of the kings of Judah. As John Gill says, the kings of Judah had analysts or historiographers to write for them, as the kings of Israel had, and we've already talked about them in verse 19 of this chapter, in the writing of which annals, especially with respect to genealogies, Shemaiah the prophet and Iddo the seer were concerned. And of course, this is not, the King James has the chronicles of the kings of Judah, but that's not talking about the canonical books of Chronicles. There was continual warfare between Rehoboam, the king of Judah in the south, and Jeroboam, the king of Judah, king of Israel in the north. And as you recall, Shemaiah had told Rehoboam not to go after Jeroboam at the division in 930 B.C. at the very beginning of their reigns, or 931 B.C. at the very beginning of their reigns. But later on, they ended up fighting each other. Jameson Fawcett Brown says, Rehoboam was prohibited from entering on an aggressive war, talking about in 931 at the beginning of their reigns. But as the two kingdoms kept up a jealous rivalry, he might be forced into vigilant measures of defense, and frequent skirmishes would take place on the borders. So in verse 31, Abijah, his son, succeeded him as king, and Adam Clark has an interesting comment about this, quote, though righteousness cannot be propagated because it is supernatural, yet unrighteousness may be propagated, for that is a genuine offspring of nature. Abijam was the wicked son of an apostate father and heathenish mother. Grace may be grafted on a crab stock, but let none do evil that good may come of it. A bad stock will produce bad fruit. In other words, Clark saying it's just natural that an unrighteous father would have an unrighteous son, but I don't know if that's true. A lot of times you see godly people with horrible parents. Doesn't happen often, but it happens sometimes. A lot of times you see very evil people. Think about John Piper's son going out on the internet and trashing everything that his father says. God's not real. I'm a professional atheist. He's actually just showing his rebellion against his father and against God himself by making an idiot out of himself, because the Bible says the fool in his heart says there is no God. So he's making a fool out of himself publicly on YouTube. Well, he had a good father. So I won't get into that. I know that you try to give kids the best environment they have, and that increases their chance that they're going to come out righteous, but it's not a guarantee. At any rate, Abijam was not righteous, as we'll see as we proceed through the book of Kings. Ladies and gentlemen, I hope you stay tuned for our next audio, which will be covering 1 Kings 15, verses 1 through 33, Abijam in Judah. And we'll also look at Nadab and Baasha in Israel in the north. I hope you will enjoy that audio, and I hope you have enjoyed this one.